The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche is famous for many things. But one of his quotes that I really like might be familiar to all of you. He said, "Those who the gods would destroy, they first make mad." Now, not a lot of people know that 2 months ago, a law was passed by the Houses of Parliament which did away with the banning of people who could sit in Parliament who are mentally insane. This law dates back a long, long time, and it was there to prevent people who are mentally insane from sitting in Parliament. That law was rescinded in the name of an anti-discrimination law. So now it is legally possible for someone who is mentally insane to sit in the Houses of Parliament. Some of us would say there's no change. Some of us would suggest there are over 600 of them already there. But talking of quotes, whenever I think of Parliament, I think of Oscar Wilde. Because as you know, Oscar Wilde was put on trial in the late 1880s. He was put on trial in London for alleged homosexuality. And while he was on trial, while he was in the dock, the judge asked him, he said, "Mr. Wilde, this house where the acts allegedly took place, is it a house of repute?" To which Mr. Wilde responded, "Your Honor, I always thought so. But now, looking at the map and seeing how close it is to Westminster, I'm now no longer so sure." Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that what we're dealing with down in Westminster is the most vicious, viperous gang of traitors that this country has ever faced. They have created, when I say they, I do not mean the Labour Party alone. I mean the Tories as well, and the Lib Dems. For successive generations, successive governments, they have all worked together, flat out, to create a society which is institutionally anti-white. They accuse us of being the racists. In actual fact, they are the biggest racists of all, because they have created an entire culture, an entire society, which is geared up to discriminate against the white British people of this country. And if you think I'm joking, cast your mind back to when the BNP held its rally, its day of action in Stoke, just a couple of weeks ago. You all remember that? Probably many of you were there. We had nearly 800 people on the streets of Stoke, leafleting everywhere. And they were ordinary folk, just like you are here tonight. And the BBC, in their greatness, that paragon of truth and virtue, broadcast that night a report which said that the BNP had rallied 300 tattooed and shaven skinheads in Stoke that day, all in boots and braces. And then, even though the video coverage showed that they were lying, they then went down to the local mosque in Stoke, one of the local mosques in Stoke, and they managed to find Mr. Nazir Khan standing on the steps outside the mosque, and they interviewed him, and they said, "Mr. Khan, what do you think of the BNP in Stoke here today?" And ladies and gentlemen, this was broadcast on national television. And Mr. Khan, do you know what his answer was? His answer was that whites are ignorant, they don't read, they're backward, that's why they vote BNP, and they're a disgrace to the city of Stoke. That was broadcast on national television, and it is still on the BBC website to this day. Look up the BBC News website, you'll see it. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I write every day on the BNP's main website, and I'm telling you now, if I had to write an article which said that Muslims are backward, ignorant, they're a disgrace to the city, and they don't read, I will be locked up that very day for race hatred. But the truth is, they can write that about you, they can write that about white people, because of this institutional anti-white racism which permeates all of society. And you know it. You know it to be true. The earlier example, what Duncan Warner mentioned it in the earlier part of this meeting. Everyone knows who Stephen Lawrence was, even though no one's ever yet been convicted of his murder, by the way. Everyone knows who he is, but no one's heard of Chris Donald. No one's heard of the nearly 300 white kids who've been murdered by non-whites in this country over the past 5 years. And that, ladies and gentlemen, forms the basis of our Racism Cuts Both Ways campaign. Exposing institutional anti-white racism in this country. We are an anti-racist party. Let this be understood very, very clearly. And let this also be understood that if there is anybody here who's in this room, who's in this party, because they hate anybody else, because of the colour of their skin, or their religion, or their ethnic origin, let me tell you now that you're in the wrong party. The actions which we undertake are not based on hating anybody or hating any immigrant. They are based on a desire to keep Britain British. It is based on a desire to love and preserve what we have. And that does not mean hating anybody else. It does not mean looking down on anybody else. It does not mean denigrating anybody else. The reality is that white people in Britain are the victims of racism. Let me give you some more examples. Just a few years ago, this Labour Party government appointed an academic from Oxford, a professor from Oxford, and they commissioned him to find out why white boys were doing so poorly at schools in certain areas in the country. And he did all his research, government-funded, i.e. your taxpayer money. He did all his research, and his report, which was handed into Parliament, said the reason why white boys do poorly at school in certain areas of the country is because they come from homes with parents who have low expectations, and that transfers onto the children, and therefore they don't do as well at school because they have a lower expectation of themselves. And that report was passed through Parliament, and everyone said, oh yes, that sounds quite good, and they'll put it to one side. Earlier this year, that same academic was appointed by the same government to produce a report on why black boys were doing poorly at schools in Britain. Because they are, in the terms of the school tables, they're at the bottom of the heap. So the government said, find out why black boys are doing poorly at school. So he did his research, once again with your tax money, did his research, interviewed, did the whole thing, produced his report before Parliament, and what did the report say? The reason why black boys do poorly at school is because the white teachers are racist. So listen to the logic, ladies and gentlemen. When white kids do poorly at school, it's white people's fault. And when black kids do poorly at school, it's also white people's fault. Do you understand what I mean about institutional anti-racism? You are to blame for everything that goes wrong. There's nothing that goes wrong which isn't your fault. Give you another example. What wasn't 3 months ago that the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, the SRA, which is the body which governs all the solicitors in Britain, they were dragged over the coals by the Commission for Racial Equality, or the Race Gestapo. Why? Because the statistics of the number of prosecutions of fraudulent solicitors came out. And shock, horror, nearly 80% of all the solicitors who've been prosecuted for fraud in Britain come from the Muslim or the Asian community. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you or I had to get that figure, let's say I produced a report which said that comparing the two towns of Stoke and Manchester, or say two towns of equivalent size, and you would say that there are more people, the statistics would show that more people were prosecuted in Stoke for fraud than in Manchester, say for example. What would your conclusion be? Well, there must be more crooks in Stoke than in Manchester. That would be the logical conclusion. Yep? No. Not according to the Race Gestapo. The reason why they said the SRA prosecutes more Muslim or Asian solicitors in Britain is because the SRA, which is the white organisation, is institutionally racist. Not because there are more crooked Muslim lawyers in Britain. And it happens again and again and again. Just this very week we had yet another example of where poor academic performance at schools by the ethnic minorities is blamed on white teachers. Once again, despite the fact that we all know that the National Union of Teachers is by far the most crazily left-wing organization of public servants that you could ever hope to meet. The National Union of Teachers, NUT, is a good reason why they're called NUT. But the truth is that not even they are exempt from it. Not even the crazy leftists are exempt from it. Because what did we have just the other week? The reason why after Obama, Barack was elected president of America, what did Trevor Phillips and the race Gestapo say? It's impossible for the Labour Party ever to have that because the Labour Party is full of racists. It's crazy. Every time anything goes wrong, it's your fault. But have you, ladies and gentlemen, this is how far it's gone, is that they always talk about the ethnics. Yep, when I say ethnic, everyone knows what I'm talking about. I'm talking about non-white, am I? Right, I'm talking about Nigerian or Jamaican or Afro-Caribbean or whatever their definitions are, or Asian or whatever it is. When I say ethnic, everyone knows that it's a code word for non-white. So they are the ethnics. What are you? You've even been written out of the right to be called an ethnic group. You are an ethnic group. But in the parlance of the establishment, in the parlance of the ruling elite, you don't even deserve the title ethnic. What you are, ladies and gentlemen, is nothing but milk cows for your own funeral. You're being taxed for your own funeral. You have to pay for this multicultural experiment. And it is a massive bill. It is a monstrous bill. People don't understand how much money is spent. They talk about, oh, they're going to give us a tax break. Yeah, this pre-budget report, or they allege that this is tax cuts and VAT cuts, I don't know what else. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, it is possible to have tax cuts and increased services. Because the Tories will tell you they're going to cut taxes, but then also the services are going to go down. Because, goodness gracious, we can't have state-controlled services, can we, according to the Tories? And Labour will tell you, well, we'll increase taxes slightly, and then we'll spend a little bit more, we'll have a little bit more there. The truth is, it's possible to have a synthesis of lower taxes and increased services. And why do you do that? You simply reallocate the funds, your money, which is being spent on this crazy, criminal, multicultural experiment. And it cuts across all levels of government, all levels. There's an entire race relations industry worth billions of pounds. They pump millions and who knows how much into it, into the race relations industry. There are race relations boards up and down this country. There are organizations, government-funded organizations, working for the interests of every single non-white ethnic group in this country except white people. We don't believe me? Go down to your local offices, go down to your local government offices and ask them for the adult education supplement book. You'll be shocked to see the programs that they run. You are actually paying, your tax money is being used to pay for Islamic education centers at the mosques. If you don't believe me, go look it up. You are paying to teach Bengal children in Northampton, to teach children of Bengal immigrants the Bengalese language. Can you imagine? Can you imagine for a second Brits going to India and demanding from the Indian government money to teach British children English at home? It wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. Ladies and gentlemen, it's possible to do all these things with just a bit of common sense. The British foreign aid budget is £7.8 billion a year. Go spread out to all manner of third world countries and some not so third world. There's millions going to India. Yeah, you all know India's just, it's got its own space program, planning a moonshot, just landed a satellite on the moon. And you're giving them tax money in foreign aid. What a bizarre set of circumstances. Britain doesn't even have a satellite. We're members of the European Space Agency. So all the European countries sort of band together to send one rocket up, but we can give billions and millions of pounds to a country that has its own space program, that has nuclear weapons. Time has come to call a halt to foreign aid and spend that money in Britain. They finally admitted what the NHS deficit is after years of jumping around pretending they didn't know. They finally admitted, you know what the NHS deficit is? The reason why all the NHS units are closing down around the country? The NHS deficit is apparently £2.4 billion. A third of the foreign aid budget. So they would rather give money to the third world than to spend money on the British people's own health services. And that's why they're closing this unit down, they're closing that unit down. There's a whole industry behind this. There's a whole industry behind this. Listen to the madness, ladies and gentlemen, of privatization, which doesn't come from the Labour Party. The Labour Party's carried it on. It comes from the Tories. And might I add here, that any of you who think that the Labour is our enemy, let me tell you now, the Tories are on course to win the next election, and they are the enemy. The Tories, ladies and gentlemen, started the whole privatization thing. Imagine this, in the country which invented railways, which invented the train, they refused to invest for a decade or so in the railways so that it reached a point where it was sufficiently poor they could justify selling it off. So they sold it off to all their Tory buddy lords. And now it's run on a profit basis with results that your average working person can't afford to commute on the trains anymore, pushing them onto the roads. And now it's because it's run on a profit basis, still hasn't got any better because they've got shareholders to feed. Anyone who's travelled on the train between London and Paris will testify to this, that when you get on that train in London, and it clunks along. You know it's got two sets of wheels. Because it has to swap wheels. It's got a very sophisticated system. Because the British tracks are so poor and so narrow gauge that it can't travel fast enough. So it travels, it clunks away at 80 kilometres an hour till it gets to the Channel Tunnel. Goes through there. When it hits France, bang, the big wheels come down and it zooms off at 180 odd kilometres an hour. And what's the difference? The French SNCF is state-owned, and the British Railways is privately owned. But you paid for that. You paid for that, ultimately. And here, we have another example. They sold off, just recently sold off the last of Britain's power stations. And the justification was that because it's uneconomical for the state to own it. It should be privatized. If it's privatized, it's run properly and efficiently and for profit, and it'll work well. That was the justification. So the tax money which they've taken from you to build these things, they've now sold them off for a short-term financial input because they're short of money, as always, because they're spending it everywhere on the race relations industry and foreign aid and who knows what else. And they tell you it's got to be privately owned. That's why we're selling it off. But ladies and gentlemen, who have they sold it to? They sold it to EDF. Do you know what EDF stands for? It's French. The state-owned electricity supply company in France. So it's not all right for the British people to own British nuclear power stations, but it's all right for the French state to own it. And to make matters worse, in France, EDF is subject to state rules, so they can't overcharge for electricity in France. So what they do is they buy up the British power stations, they overcharge for electricity here, and they use that to cross-subsidize France. Can you imagine such treason? Can you imagine the French government selling its power stations to Germany? I wouldn't think of it for a second. But that's the level of the treason with which we're dealing here. You all remember the lies told for the Iraq War. The great, great war to save Europe. Remember the missiles that carried anthrax and the nuclear weapons that were going to bombard Europe and all that. All lies, all pack of lies. You remember all of that? You know how much we spent, Britain has spent on the Iraq War, never mind the 300 dead? You know how much we spent on the Iraq War so far? The conservative estimate is £8 billion. £8 billion for that senseless war, unjust war, for which we will pledge that the culprits, the leaders of the government and even the heads of the army will pay in war crimes trials when we come to power. That money money of yours that's been spent on those senseless wars. And they say, oh, we haven't got enough money to keep the state services running. Haven't got enough money that our pensioners can get a decent living pension. They have to choose between eating or heating. That's the type of treason that you're dealing with. But ladies and gentlemen, the worst part of it is that they have all been participants to a conscious plan to ensure that you are replaced by third world immigrants within the next 40 to 60 years. You know the demographics. I'm sure I don't have to tell you. They're already publicly broadcast in the media. We know that within the next 10 to 12 years, almost every single one of the large cities in Britain are going to be overrun by third world immigrants, with a majority third world immigrant populations. You know that. We know the figures are already out, that 22% of all primary school children are from the so-called ethnic minorities, and 17% of all secondary school children are from the so-called ethnic minorities. That's more than a third of all the school-age-going children in this country are from the ethnic minorities. Do you know what that means, ladies and gentlemen? That means in two and a half generations, you will have been replaced as the majority population in this country. That's how close it is. And if you're wondering, well, two and a half generations, what does that mean? That's 50 to 60 years. You want to know how quickly 50 to 60 years goes? It's been longer than that since the end of the Second World War. That's how quickly it goes. That's why the struggle with which we are engaged is not something to do with the mundane of politics. We do the mundane of politics as well, of course. We talk about the local issues and the things which determine where the roads go and all that type of stuff. But the reality is that the core issue with which we engage ourselves is whether Britain survives or not. Whether Britain will be a first world country in the next 100 years or not. We deal with matters of life and death. And when people often hear me talk for the first time, they say, oh, listen to that accent. Hasn't he got a funny accent? And I say, no, it's you people who got the funny accent. The truth is that I was born in the British colony of Southern Rhodesia. When the British people, my family went out there from Kent, when British people went out there, it was a barren land. There was nothing there. There were two literally Stone Age tribes battling it out. And British people went out to that country. It wasn't even a country at that stage. It was just an open piece of bush, felt they called it. And when they got there, they replicated a little bit of Britain there. They built houses, roads, schools, farms, universities, all the things which you take for granted as you walk around here. And what they did, ladies and gentlemen, they made a little bit of Britain in Africa. And here, let's be honest, they forced their way of life upon the local people. They forced the locals to speak English. They forced them to wear clothes. They forced them to go to school. They forced British culture and the British way of life upon those people. They did it. Let's not get away from that fact. And it was done through coercion. This is the truth. I'm not going to make excuses for it. It was done through coercion. And then ultimately, when the demographics turned against the settlers to the point where it was no longer physically possible to control this ballooning black population, the country was turned back over to its majority population. And what's happened in Zimbabwe since then is a matter for another debate. But the truth is, the British people then left after forcing their way of life upon the local people. And the truth is that it was wrong, although I personally didn't do it, it was wrong of us to go to Africa and turn Africa into a bit of Britain. But ladies and gentlemen, it was wrong for us to force our culture and our ways upon Africa. Then surely it is wrong for Africa to come to Britain and force Britain to become a bit of Africa. I say, this has nothing to do with hating anybody. This has got absolutely nothing to do with hating anybody. But think of it this way, ladies and gentlemen. What would Pakistan say if 10 million Brits packed their bags tomorrow, jumped on planes and settled in Lahore in Pakistan? Took over the city and said, right, knock that mosque down, we'll build a church. Oh, knock that mosque down, we'll turn it into a pub. Let's get to the, I'll get some breweries going. Oh, we'll have a soccer game here, a football match here. And in other words, close down that carrier shop, turn it into a fish and chip shop. Imagine what the Pakistanis would say. Imagine what they would say. They'd be furious. And they'd chuck us all out. And you know what? They'd be right to do so. They'd be right to do so. Because they have a right to preserve their own culture and their own customs and their own ways in their own country. But we have a right to preserve our culture and our customs and our ways in our own country as well. And it's not hatred to say that you want to preserve what you have. No one in their right mind would dream of going to any second or third world country and telling them they don't have the right to be who they are. No one would go to Japan and tell the Japanese, sorry, in 20 years' time, Tokyo is no longer going to be a Japanese city, it's going to be a British Christian city. They'd chuck you out. No one would go to Beijing in China and tell the Chinese, sorry, no longer Chinese, it's going to be a French city. No one in their right mind would say that to China or to any second or third world country. The immigration problem, ladies and gentlemen, isn't even a problem. It's an invasion. The immigration invasion is purely, exclusively, third world to first world. And we have a right to protect and defend what we have. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, we are the true champions of diversity. They always tell us, oh, we're against diversity. What's wrong with diversity? Their impression of diversity is a few more curry shops and what they actually mean is more gun crime in London or more knife crime in London, something like that. They tell us that we're against diversity. I want to tell you, we are for diversity. Don't let anybody kid yourself. Diversity means each nation having its own culture and its own way. In its own territory. And the great thing about diversity is being able to tour around and see different cultures and see different peoples. When I go to China and I tour China, I want to see Chinese people building the wall, Great Wall of China. I want to see Chinese people in Beijing. When I go to Tokyo, I want to see Japanese people. When I go to Hawaii, I want to see Hawaiian people. When I go to Nigeria, if I go to Nigeria, I want to see Nigerian people. And when I go to Britain, I want to see British people. And it's not racist to say that that has a distinct racial aspect to it. It's not. If I said to you all, look, there's a Japanese person over there, you all turned around and looked, and there was a black as the ace of spades Nigerian there, you would say, wait, where's a Japanese person? Yeah? No one thinks of a Japanese person as black. If I said, look, there's a Chinese person there, you turn around there and there was some blonde goddess standing there, you would say, wait, where's a Chinese person? Chinese people, Japanese people. When you use the word Chinese, when you use the word Japanese, you are implicitly saying a racial thing. It's not denigrating anybody to say that. If I said, look, there's a Nigerian, you turn around and you see 20 white people, you say, where's the Nigerian? Don't you? Of course. So when I say, look, there's a British person, I mean a Northwestern European person. And there's nothing racist in that. We don't look down on anybody. You must understand this, ladies and gentlemen. The struggle with which we are involved has got nothing to do with alleged notions of superiority or inferiority. Got nothing to do with it at all. Don't think that because the IQ tests show that white people allegedly have a higher IQ that they're going to survive. It's got nothing to do with it. People who walk around saying, oh, we're cleverer than they are, don't know what they're talking about, because if you're honest, who's winning the war for demographic control of Britain? Is it the people with supposedly the higher IQ? Or is it the people with supposedly the lower end of the IQ scale? If you're honest, you'll see, you'll admit. The truth is, this goes about demographics. This goes about who forms the majority population. Because who forms the majority population will determine the nature of the civilization in a given territory. It has always been like that. There has never been an example throughout history where a civilization has not come to an end for any other reason except that the founding population has been replaced by an immigrant population. Not one. And it's not rocket science to conceptualize this. It's not way out stuff. If the Chinese people made the Chinese civilization and the Chinese people vanished tomorrow, the Chinese civilization will vanish with them. Because the Chinese people made it. It's logic. Don't need a PhD to work this out. The British culture is a product of the British people. If the British people vanish, are squeezed into minority status in Britain, British culture will change to reflect that. And if you don't believe this is happening, go and look at how the skyline of London is changing. In the 1930s, there was one mosque in London, in Regent's Park. Today, there are over 700. And we're told, we've got no accurate figures for it yet, we're told there's an average of 30 opening every month around the country. What we are seeing, ladies and gentlemen, is the colonization of Britain by third world immigrants. And if it is left unchecked and unreversed, you will be a minority in this country within 2 to 3 generations. That is why the struggle with which we are involved will be fought and won, or fought and lost by the people in this room. This is not a struggle for the previous generation. This is not a struggle for the next generation. This is a struggle which will be determined by what you do. This is a struggle which will be determined by how far you're prepared to sacrifice, by what you're prepared to give up for the better good of the broader community. During the time of the American Revolution, 1776, when British colonists in North America rose up against tyranny, it's not a thing which people in Britain really like to discuss or even think about too much. They regard the British colonists in North America who rose up against King George as some type of traitors. In actual fact, ladies and gentlemen, they were rising against tyranny of their time. King George III had imposed taxation without representation and wished to abolish the fledgling colony assemblies, the fledgling colony parliaments that they were busy building in the 13 colonies of North America. And they begged and pleaded with King George to stop it and to grant them their liberty and grant them their rights. And when finally they were faced with no other choice, they rose up in open rebellion, and that was the cause of the American Revolution. It was kith against kin, cousin against cousin. And one of the co-authors of the American Declaration of Independence was a man called Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson, his mother was born here in the Midlands, and his father was born in North Wales. That tells you who he was. And he wrote that in order to survive, the tree of liberty needs to be watered from time to time with the blood of tyrants and the blood of martyrs. And we've had more than enough martyrs sacrifice their blood for the tree of liberty. Our ancestors have shed their blood to give us what we have today. Everything that we have, everything we take for granted, has been won through sacrifice of British people being prepared to go to the furthest. It is a sobering thought, ladies and gentlemen, to think that voting rights for women in Britain is less than 100 years old. It is a sobering thought to think that adult male franchise is less than 200 odd years old in this country. The rights which we take for granted were won by struggle against tyranny. Were won by people who were prepared to go out and state their claim and say, no, this is wrong, we will stand up against it. And we've seen it again over the past week, where 13 men in Liverpool distributing a perfectly legal leaflet pointing out the institutional anti-white racism of the current regime have been arrested on trumped up charges. In fact, the charges are so trumped up they can't even formulate them. They've been released on unconditional bail until February next year to try and give the prosecution authority a chance to find something to charge them with. We've had our martyrs, the 300 odd kids who've been killed by non-white ethnic violence in Britain over the past 500 years, and whose names are ignored by the BBC and the other media outlets. The 300 soldiers, men and women, who died in Iraq for an illegal, immoral war, which has caused terrorism in this country. That's caused terrorism in this country. We've had our martyrs. Now it is the time for the tyrants to pay. And that's what we're about. We will not stop. We will not bow. We will never surrender until the tyrants have paid in order to keep the tree of liberty alive. Because we have an obligation to all of those who've come before us. We have a duty. It is a holy duty that those who have sacrificed all to give us what we have, that we have an obligation to them to pass that on to the next generation. We have an obligation to take what is great from the past, discard what is bad, and build on for the greatness of the future. And we owe it to the upcoming generation and the as of yet unborn generations, that they will not be born and raised in a country in which they are a persecuted minority, that they will not be born and raised in a nation which is rapidly turning into a third world hellhole, that they will not be born and raised in a nation where they are the second and the third class citizens. We have an obligation. And one of Thomas Jefferson's compatriots at the time of the American Revolution, a man called Patrick Henry, also of English descent, halfway through the American Revolutionary War, which lasted 4 years, halfway through the war, the colonists got together and they had what they called the Continental Congress. And at the Congress they had to decide whether they would continue the war against England or not, because they knew they were fighting their own cousins. And the Congress debated whether they would continue the war. And Patrick Henry stood up and gave an impassioned speech, and he ended with the words, "Give me liberty or give me death." And that roused them into action. And they finally won. They took their liberty from the tyrannical ruling elite. And we will not stop until we have taken our liberty back from this ruling elite who seek to destroy us. We will not stop. And I don't care what people say, that it's too difficult, the powers are too strong, look at they can smear us in the media, they can put our names on the internet, and we don't care, because we know that this struggle is something which we have to do. We don't ask whether the struggle, whether this goal is achievable or not. We don't ask whether we can do it or not. We ask only if it must be done or not. And if it must be done, we will do it, or we will perish in the attempt, because doing nothing is the same thing as perishing. And that is why they think they can stop us. They think they can intimidate us into backing down. All they're doing is making us bolder. All they're doing is ensuring that next time when we go out to Liverpool this coming Saturday, there won't be 13 of us, there'll be hundreds of us. And let's see them take us down then when there are hundreds of us. And this will spread like a wildfire throughout the country. Because all over, there are many, many people who are waking up to what's going on. People say, well, how do you know? How can you say this? Let me give you some statistics, which will prove it to you. The last time the entire country could vote as a whole for the BNP was in June 2004, in the Euro elections. I'm sure many of you were involved in that campaign. You know how many votes we got across the entire country in June 2004? Any guesses?
808,000.
Exactly. 808,000. Ladies and gentlemen, on the 1st of May this year, we stood in the London GLA top up list, and we stood in 629 wards across Britain. That was a bare minimum that we had to qualify for a TV broadcast. Do you know how many wards there are actually across the entire country? In excess of 24,000. We stood in a paltry 629 of them. Do you know how many people came out and put their crosses next to the BNP? How many numbers, actual numbers of people, put their crosses next to the BNP on the 1st of May this year? In those paltry 629 wards and in the London GLA elections? Just under 500,000. Now imagine if we had candidates in all of the wards that were up for grabs. Imagine how many votes we would have had. I'm telling you now that there are millions of British people who are now prepared to say, we've had enough, just so far and no further. And they're prepared now to come out and support the only political party which is unashamedly for the rights of the indigenous white British people.
Yes.
And we're not ashamed of it. We're not ashamed of it. We'll tell this anyway. We'll speak it out anyway. If there are organisations working for the interests of the so-called ethnic minorities, soon to be majorities, if there are organisations working for their interests, why can there not be an organisation working for the interests of white British people? If there can be a black police officers association, why not a white police officers association? If there can be a music of black origin awards, why not a music of white origin awards? If there can be a Miss Black Britain competition, which there is, officially sanctioned, why not a Miss White Britain competition? And the list goes on and on and on. The truth is that the modern heretics, the modern Jews, are in fact white people who are being persecuted, who are being locked up for daring to say that we will not bow before tyranny. We will not stop our struggle. We will never give in until once again Britain will take its place in the world as a free, proud, white European nation. Once again.